Welcome everyone to, man, I keep forgetting to remember what episode number it is, and I write it literally right before I like call you. It's like episode 25, I think. I'm here with Smix, and I'm really excited for this one, as you have been here from the beginning of the, I guess, the second wave of esports that was the StarCraft II hullabaloo back in 2010. You've worked your way up to not just be one of the best hosts in the industry, but obviously you've worked closely with Twitch and just become kind of a pillar of this community that we know as esports. Plus, you know, I've been friends with you for quite some time, so I'm excited to get to actually chatting with people I haven't seen in forever, because it's been the COVID year. So that's why I'm mostly excited. But yeah, thanks for coming on, Smix. I'm glad to have you.
Oh, thanks, Jess. I think that was the nicest introduction, or actually it was the nicest compliment I think I've ever gotten from you. The part well, from
me sound
the
good.
Pillars of the space and one of the greatest hosts, like these words, I don't know what to do. I'm so flustered right now.
I guess I'm not really usually a very like complimenty person. I've never like expected anyone to be like, nice job. Every time they do, I'm just like, oh thanks. So yeah. I don't think about doing it to other people.
I'm such a words of affirmation person that as soon as I get it, I'm like, I'm like, oh, thanks. Let me hold on to this.
Yeah. You're the one that introduced me to that. I don't remember what mine was, though. I remember I didn't like gift giving.
Yeah, I actually find that a lot of the people that I get closer to also don't like gift giving, which is hilarious. I'm curious if that's some sort of subconscious setting of mine that is trying to avoid spending money on others. By surrounding myself with people that also don't like gifts.
I mean,
yeah, but maybe yours was like quality time or acts of service or physical
it
touch.
Might have been.
I'm literally going through every other.
I know. It's like it might have been any of these other ones.
It's going to be one of the other three. It has to be.
Yeah, it's definitely not physical touch. I don't think I really put that up there too much. Okay, I'm not so a hugger either.
So. Okay, so we're down to quality time and acts of service.
Isn't there five, though?
Did I not say five? Oh, and words of affirmation.
Right. That's what we started with. Anyways, this isn't about love language, believe it or not. This is about commentary, and in your case, hosting and interviewing, and even a little bit of translating, although that hasn't really been your main job, it feels, for a few years. Mm-hmm. But anyways.
Thank God. So
you don't, I know you've always been nervous about it, but you're nervous about everything. So it's really hard to scale it.
No, the thing is, maybe a lot of people don't know this about me, but I was born in Korea, but I essentially moved to New York when I was only 10 months old. So speaking Korean has never really been a native thing for me. I spoke enough to have very basic conversations with my parents, but I would equate my level of speaking Korean to like an elementary school, like a kid who just entered elementary school. That's how basic my Korean was. And anything else I learned from watching K-dramas, etc. So when I first started translating for StarCraft, it was a very overwhelming thing because, you know, not only are these players using more elaborate words I would never use myself, but also there's a lot of slang and technical jargon when it comes to StarCraft II related speak. So it was really nerve-wracking for me at first. And even to this day, even though I've gotten a lot better with learning a lot of that slang and technical words, it's still difficult for me. It's like I have to reach into this other like dusty cobwebbed part of my brain and dust it off and think to myself, okay, he just said this. What is it for that? So yeah, that's why I get extra nervous for that.
Yeah. But like I said, you kind of feel you have this air of nervousness around everything you do just by having done it for years. So but yeah, I know you've talked about that before and just how difficult it is. I mean, did you ever go for like Korean classes to brush up, especially during some of the heydays of the Koreans coming over? StarCraft?
That's the thing, though. It's like that wouldn't have helped because the main words I was having problems with at first were all technical words related to StarCraft. Mm. So these are not words I could have learned from taking a Korean class. There were a couple of other words that were not StarCraft II related that I learned just by either not knowing what it was and asking afterward, or getting help from some of the other really good Korean speakers in the space. Like Wax Angel has helped me a ton over the last decade or so of knowing him. He's helped me so much with random words I didn't know. Brian Choi, he is someone that more recently helped me in the last couple of years, especially when I didn't know any words. Like I would just DM him or Kakao him and I'd be like, okay, what does this word mean? And he'd be really helpful with that as well. So I would say there's been a lot of people that have helped me, but in general, it wasn't a situation where I could just like take a Korean class and know what they were.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be difficult. But I guess then well, the way you would do it maybe is watching like the Korean casters?
It actually, so maybe again, this will surprise people, but what I would do is because I would be prepping the questions in advance, I would try to predict what their answer would be. So for example, if the question was about a specific strategy that they used, like, why did you choose to do X strategy in that position early in the game? And I predicted that the answer would be, oh, I went for that because I know he tends to play greedy and I wanted to capitalize on that. If I can predict that that's what the answer is, then I would beforehand kind of look and make sure I had all those words ready. So it was like all this preemptive work I was doing almost. And that's kind of the secret I give is because I was in a position where I knew I was working from a disadvantage of not knowing all the words. I did my best to try to not only prepare the questions in advance, but also predict what their answer would be. So I would have those answers ready as well.
Okay. Yeah. So, well, did you not spend much time with the Koreans then? Because I feel like I watch other Korean translators and they're usually like afterwards, like kind of just chatting. There's the difference of you who go with the rest of the English commentators. And then a lot of these Korean translators go with the Korean guys, like yeah. just hanging out with them. So did you never do that?
Yeah, I never did. And I think it's because, again, I never really identified as a Korean, so to speak. I've always felt like I was super, super American. And even when I go to Korea, I'm told this, right? It's apparent from everything from how I do my makeup to how I dress to even how I walk. My friend was like, oh, I could tell it was you because of you were walking weird. And I'm like, what do you mean? It's just how I walk. And she was like, no one in Korea walks like you. And I couldn't figure out what that meant, but okay. So it's like I reek Americanness in everything that I do. And I'm sure to a certain degree it's mental as well, but I for the most part don't like to go out of my way to speak with pro players, not because I don't like them or anything like that, but I think I just have it in my mind where it's like in a tournament setting, especially if they are still playing, don't disrupt them. Like, don't bother them. They might be in a headspace of trying to prepare. They might be in a not great headspace and it's not really obvious, but don't really bother them unless they give a very explicit green light to do so. And because I was never sure, I always prefer to play it safe and not put myself in a situation where I'm potentially disrupting them in any shape or form.
Yeah, I definitely get that. I mean, even being friends with some of these pros and pretty good friends too, and I'll still just be like, well, I'm not going to go up there, which is why occasionally in the past when apparently, you know, they like GSL, a couple people come up and talk to like anyone. Apparently in the past, there's actually been guys, like people who just don't understand that and they just freely walk up to these guys. And I'm just like, I can't even do it. And I'm like pretty close friends with some of them.
And the difficult part is it's not even just during the tournament, but I don't feel comfortable going up to them after the tournament either because different players stomach losses differently. And I've seen firsthand how hard some players can take losses. So I just have this sensitivity towards approaching them, period. Like I, A, don't want to disrupt them, and B, I don't want to make them feel worse after they already feel like trash and they might not want to talk to anyone.
Yeah.
So it's just, it puts me in a situation where I'm very rarely talking to pro players.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I get that as well. Usually I wait for them to come up to like the group. They kind of like, I feel like there's like an acknowledgement that's very silent. If someone just lost, but they want to hang out and they're kind of like sullen a little bit. They don't really want to speak, but after the initial like, okay, who's going to acknowledge the guy who just lost is like right here. Someone's just like, hey man, like how you feeling? And then they'll talk and be like, oh, I don't feel so great. Let's just go have a drink or something, which is totally fine.
Yeah.
But you don't want to be the one to go to them and then initiate if they don't want to. So
absolutely.
But I think for you, it's actually pretty, whereas the commentators, I guess are supposed to kind of, I mean, there's definitely benefits to being close with the pros and talking with them on a pretty casual, but still frequent basis. but perhaps it is greater for interviews. Actually, I'm not positive about that one, but you know, you're supposed to be asking them maybe some even pretty tough questions. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've even, I don't know if you've personally done any loser interviews, but I know that's kind of popping up. Yeah. And like, how do you wish sometimes that you knew them better, or is that actually a good thing to have that kind of bit of distance?
No, I think it's almost always better to know them better. I think if I look back on the interviews that I've done and that I've enjoyed the most, I always have a easier time both conducting the interview, but also getting better answers when it's a player that I'm closer to. So of course, in an ideal world, I wish I could be close to all of them so that these interviews, I feel like there's less territory I shouldn't go near, so to speak, because the closer you are to someone, the more everything's kind of up for grabs and they have that rapport with you that you can broach all sorts of topics. Mm-hmm. So in an ideal world, of course, I wish I was closer to them, but it's like a balance of trying to respect them and their space and their time and not trying to force anything. Because I've seen that as well, where sometimes people can try to force a friendship or force a level of comfort without taking the time to do it in a slower manner. And the player can almost retract more into their shell. So I've been playing it very slow and steady, and I would like to think that after this many years now with the players repeatedly talking to me for interviews over and over again, it was a slower route, but I do think that they feel more, I would hope so, at least comfortable with me.
Yeah, I think we've seen that a bit. I mean, some of it is them just getting older and I guess just more comfortable with themselves, but I think it is nice. I mean, I think, you know, we think about maybe Sarah getting better at interviews, but I think Neeb is also one of the
guys. Oh, absolutely. It was so funny because back in 2017, 2018, or 2017 Neeb, 2018 Sarah, I was speaking with them all the time, all the freaking time. And I remember in the beginning, it was a struggle for me to figure out the best way to structure the interview so that they stopped feeling uncomfortable with the more feelsy, vague questions, and I quickly realized they feel way more comfortable with the technical strategic questions. So it was this struggle of like, okay, there are still times I need to ask a feelsy question depending on where they're at in the event. I can't just only ask strategic questions if they're in the grand finals. Like that's insane. So it was a struggle, but I am now at a point where I feel like both Neeb and Cyril give great interviews. They've come out and blossomed out of their shells so beautifully. It makes me so happy.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Neeb being a little bit even tongue in cheek that GSO versus the World interview, I was like, oh, he's changed.
I know. It makes me so happy.
Oh, it's great.
I feel like a mother. Mm-hmm.
So anyways, but like you know, would you say that you got into esports because of your translating or because of your interviewing?
It was the translating for sure. I mean, it was the first stepping stone, right? I got into StarCraft because of TeamLiquid.net back in 2009. And I remember at the time, I was watching all this content that was being put up online, like the MSL group selections, which MSL used to be one of the big individual leagues that was happening back in the day with StarCraft 1, Brood War. And there were two big individual leagues. It was MSL and OSL. And they would do this massive, fun group selection ceremony where basically all 16 players that had gotten there would then have this fun little session where they would take turns selecting who they wanted in their groups and why. And there would be banter and trash talk and all this type of stuff. And I realized the foreign community, which was massive on Team Liquid, had no way of knowing what they were talking about because there were no translations. So I was like, oh my God, that's such a shame that the foreign community doesn't know what they're saying, because I actually think this is so funny. Let me just go ahead and do this. And I had no idea how long translating takes. No freaking idea. I just kind of went in and I was like, let me do this casual 2-hour long VOD translation. And it took me forever, because of course I had to stop and like look up words, and it was 2 hours, let alone sometimes even just doing a written interview that's only a page long takes me an hour sometimes. So you can imagine how long this took. But I posted that, and that was my first ever post on TeamLiquid.net, was a MSL group selection translation. So that was the first step to what happened to today.
So you were in a Brood War. I don't think I actually knew this so much. Well, how much were you into Brood War? Were you a gigantic Bisou fan?
No, I wasn't a Bisou fan. I was actually a Flash fan. And I know a lot of people are like, oh, of course you like the best player ever. How surprising. No, but the reason is I feel like I become a bit of a fan of whoever is starting to dominate or starting to really pop off when I start watching something. So for example, when I first started watching StarCraft II, I was an MMA fan because that's when he had just won MLG Columbus and he used Blue Flame Hellions and was killing everything. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then back in Brood War, when I first started, oh my God, I headbutted or chin butted my microphone. I apologize. When I first started getting into Brood War, Flash was starting to dominate. And it was really cool because he was the super young kid on the block. And obviously people knew he was talented, but it was like, okay, but like how good is he really going to be? So I kind of watched his transcendence from cool new kid on the block to, oh my God, they're calling him God. Mm. So that's why I was a Flash fan.
So what year are we talking about here that you got a Brood War?
Early 2008. It was like January of 2008.
And how did you get into it?
I was in Korea for the first time as an adult. After I was born there, I didn't actually get to go back until I was 18. So I was in Korea and I was insanely jet lagged and I couldn't fall asleep. And it was like 3 a.m. and I was flipping through channels. And I don't know if this is normal, but I swear to God, in Korea, if you flip through the channels at like 3 a.m., there's a lot of raunchy shit out there. And I was like, oh my God, I was like so caught off guard. And I was like, whoa, what's going on? And I'm like awkwardly fumbling with my remote as I'm trying to find something safe to watch. Because I was also sharing a room with my aunt and I didn't want her to wake up and be like, oh my God, my 18-year-old niece is a pervert watching porn on my television. So I was like, oh God. And then I found StarCraft and I was like, whoa, this is the game my brother used to play when he was in middle school. And my brother used to play Zerg and just Zergling Rush every game. And I watched him enough to be very familiar with everything. Like I understood the concepts of the three races and the different strategies you can use and bloody, bloody, blah. Well, not the depth of the different strategies you can use, but I understood the concept of like cheesing. So when I found this pro channel, I was like, whoa, what the hell is going on? Is this like a professional thing? Like, is this like a sport, but like for StarCraft? And it was this mega boom in my brain and I couldn't believe what I was watching. So when I came home from Korea, I was like on Google and I was like, StarCraft forum and I was trying to find if there was like an online place where I could watch it, and then I accidentally discovered Team Liquid and I was like, whoa, what is this? I'm not alone. There's like thousands of other people out there that also want to watch this even though it's in a language they cannot speak. What? And that's kind of how it all started.
Dang, I didn't realize it went so far back. So you post the translations. I mean, did this directly lead to you getting any, I know jobs aren't really a thing, but getting, you know, asked to go to an event to
do
this?
Yeah, absolutely. It was totally tied together. So after I did like a year of voluntary translations, Team Liquid had this thing called like a star, which only people who earned it in some shape or form got stars.
Oh, you mean on the forums?
Yeah, it was like a star badge, and I got a star, and I was like, which is so funny because as soon as I got it, I like burned out and stopped translating. But anyway, I think by that point, I had solidified myself as like a member of the community that has helped contribute in some shape or form. And fast forward to like 2010, at this point, I was like deeply ingrained in the Team Liquid community. I was friends, like a lot of my close friends online were the Team Liquid guys, and we would all hang out and like play together and chat together every single night, bloody, bloody, blah. And then by then, you know, StarCraft II was coming out and live tournaments were being organized in NA. And when they were looking for potentially, you know, people to translate for these Koreans who, guess what? They still couldn't speak English. No way. They were asking Team Liquid. And at the time, Kennegat, who was one of the moderators for Team Liquid, was like, hey, maybe you should ask Smix. She's done translations for us on Team Liquid. Perhaps she could do it live. And that one recommendation kind of like was this chain series of events where the first event that I think I officially live translated for was IPL3 in Atlantic City.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And actually, I don't remember the order of IPLs, to be honest, when they released. I was mm-hmm. I was into MLGs for certain, but mm-hmm. you know, I really started getting into esports personally more around the late 2010, but it was released in late 2010, like early 2011, I guess, which mm-hmm. now it doesn't sound like a very late process, but then at the time mm-hmm. felt very late. So yeah, I don't remember when that was. But anyway, so you got there and you did some translating. I mean, was this just like a steady income of, not income again, because I don't know if you're being paid, but influx of gigs? Did you go to just multiple events afterwards? What was your first official?
So before the IPL3 event, I was still going to events. Like I went to MLG Pro. So to give you a timeline, IPL3 was October 2011. And then prior to that, I had been to MLG Raleigh.
Oh, okay.
Just as a fan. That was the only event I went to as a fan. And then after that, I started going to events being hired. So I got the IPL gig. And then I went to MLG Providence working for as a translator for MVP Quantic. It was like a team duo. And then after that, the following year is when I started getting asked pretty regularly by MLG. And MLG started to hire me as a translator for all of their events for the 2012 circuit.
Wow. All of them?
Yeah, I believe it was all of them. I may have missed one because I got a better monetary offer from GameSpot, I think. But it was like later in 2012.
What was the GameSpot offer?
So it's funny because like I'll just be open about the numbers now because I knew nothing and you know I was Jon Snow. So when I first the IPL gig, I think I got offered, and this was a crap ton of money for what I was doing IMO. I think they gave me $1,000 and all expenses paid, obviously, and that was like unheard of back then. That was like so much money. And I quickly realized that that was not the norm, especially for translating, like that was unheard of. And I think that the reason they also paid that much was because we were expected to pretty much player manage / player wrangle the entire weekend. So it wasn't like we were just translating on stage. We were expected to work as translators, both every time players needed something backstage, but also even when they weren't playing, helping wrangle them and stuff. But then the MLG offers afterward, the Quantic offer, I think I got paid $200 or $250 plus like flight and accommodations. And like that became what I realized was more normal. And then the MLG events, I got paid like $450 for the entire weekend for live translating on stage. And then GameSpot, the reason I took the GameSpot offer is they were offering like $1,250 or something. And I was like, oh my God, as a broke college student, that was an insane upgrade. So I said yes. But that's how the money was back then.
Yeah. Yeah. And also the situation for translators was different back then, which I had to remember just now. But, you know, before, I don't even know, really, 2013, 2014, I don't know, you could tell me.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you were just hired to translate. You would get up on stage, but then the one of the commentators most of the time would come over and give you the questions and you would translate. When did it start to morph into like someone was just like, you know, we can make her do both?
Because I remember distinctively, it was July, it was DreamHack Valencia 2013. So after almost a year and a half of just doing translations, DreamHack took a chance on me and they were like, hey, why don't you also ask the questions? And, you know, I would like to say in a beautiful world, it was because they saw the potential in me. But I really think it just came down to let's save money and just have her ask the questions. It can't be that hard. And I think that's what it really boiled down to. And I very quickly realized it is not easy. But yeah, that's a whole different topic. But yeah, July 2013 is when they had me start doing both. And that's kind of when my hosting officially started.
Yeah, okay. Well, now, I mean, it's not really even a different conversation. It's about. So tell me about what you learned for that first event and what you had to learn on the fly.
So I very quickly realized that. So translating was easy in the sense that all I had to do was regurgitate what someone else said as accurately as possible. And yes, there are difficulties with that. You don't really have to be creative in any sort of way. You're not expected to be a big presence on camera. You're not even necessarily expected to be eloquent. You just need to be as accurate as you can with what that person is saying. And, you know, I found that, even that, very difficult at times. With hosting, it was like a whole new world of difficulties, because for the first time, I had to be creative. I had to use my own brain to think of things to say, for questions to ask. And I had no concept of interview structure, how I should order questions, when to ask X, when to ask Y, when is it appropriate to bring Z up, when should I bring ABC up. Like, I had no understanding of any of that. Like, I had just, you know, like, usually people come into an industry and they have like a basic foundational understanding. I had nothing. I was literally this green child who I was like, yes, I shall do it. And I went in completely blind and it was a disaster. Oh, I hope those VODs get burned.
I'm sorry. I think I'm pretty sure they still exist.
I know. Let's move on. Don't want to encourage anyone to find those.
Well, unfortunately, yeah. I mean, I still actually... I went back recently to watch it myself after just like never wanting to, but not even uploaded. I just like, I linked it somewhere or deleted the rest of the VODs, but not that one, something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I cast Sarah versus Jadong in 2013. Woo! For a DreamHack event. And at the time Sarah was like a no one who actually was taking Jadong in his meta too.
Yeah. He was 15.
Yeah. He was very young. It was a Mutiverse Muta meta. And this guy named like Sarah was actually doing a pretty decent job. I went back and listened to it. And I was just like, thank God, like, this isn't really looked at very much. I mean, I was using like a headset mic and, oh my God. Anyways, I understand the feel. So I thought that was actually a pretty cool point of history. So I didn't want to delete it.
Mm.
Anyways. So you went into this completely green. So did you just think it was going to be like, we're talking like literally the hotel, you're getting dressed and you're like, this will be fun.
No, I was nervous.
Oh, okay.
There was never a point at which I thought this will be fun. It was more like, okay, I understand something massive has been asked of me. What can I do to try to live up to this expectation? And I really, like, I wasn't naive. Like, I went in knowing I knew nothing. It was just funny that the more I worked and the more I learned, the more I realized how nothing I knew. Does that make sense? Like, I didn't realize the extent to how little I knew. Like, I knew I knew nothing, but I didn't realize the scale of which I knew nothing until I started to learn more and more and more. And each event I worked, and each event I kept getting little tidbits of feedback here. Mm-hmm. The more I was like, wow, not only did I know nothing, I knew fucking nothing. Like, wow, had I known the Mount Everest of nothing I knew, maybe I would have reconsidered. No, I don't know. I don't mean that. I don't believe in regrets, but I almost think it's a good thing I didn't realize the extent to how little I knew. Otherwise, I think I would have thought twice about just simply saying yes. But I said yes because I was just honored to participate in what I saw as such a prestigious event and have the opportunity to help contribute towards an amazing broadcast in any shape or form. I was like, oh my God, if I can even help a little bit, I'll feel so cool.
Yeah. So, you know, with that done, did this lead into more offers pretty much immediately?
Yeah. So basically, I think DreamHack thought to themselves, okay, she wasn't good, but she wasn't an absolute train wreck. So let's keep hiring her. I think what I had going for me is, I mean, it was so fucking obvious how nervous I was. I remember after I got off the first day of hosting, I was so nervous that I couldn't eat. Like, I legit was so nauseous all day. I could not eat a single meal, and I had 6 Red Bulls because I couldn't sleep the night before either. And back then, there was no flying in 2 days beforehand to get you accustomed. No. You flew in like the day before, and then you had to go live the morning after. So you would fly in, and you're like jet lagged, and then you have to be live on broadcast 12 hours later. So I was jet lagged. I was nauseous. I couldn't eat. I had 6 Red Bulls. So you can imagine the shakiness. Like, if you watch the VOD, I swear to God, you can see my hand trembling. And it was from a combination of nerves and also the fact that I had 6 cans of Red Bull coursing through my blood. But I remember this so clearly. Both Carmack and Rotterdam DM'd me. And they were giving me advice because I think they could clearly see, like, this poor girl has no idea what she's doing. Let's offer some some hopefully good advice to guide her because she's so lost. And I'm still thankful that they did so. I mean, they didn't have to, right? But yeah, they both reached out with some advice. I was just so bad.
Mm-hmm. At this point, did you were you friends with most of the commentators, or were you really just feeling like still like a tag along?
I felt like an ultra tag along. I felt like I was the only person that didn't belong, not because they ever mistreated me or anything like that. But, you know, you can imagine as a newcomer and someone who clearly feels like they haven't mastered their craft at all. Like the word master is just not even in your head at this point. The word is more like, let's not fall on my face. Let's not fall on my face. And then I enter the lobby and it's like Tasteless and Artosis. And, you know, it's like names that I've heard back in the Bird War days. Like, oh my God, I'm working with them and they're perfect. And, you know, every time they're on camera, they're like shining stars. And meanwhile, it's me and I'm like a trash can cosplaying as a star. You know, so that was my mindset of like, oh, I really don't belong. But let's just try to do my best. I have so much to learn and I'm in good company to do that. So let me just try to watch them and learn as much as I can and ask questions where I can.
Do you remember any specific moment where you actually felt like you were part of the crew?
Dude, I swear to God, it didn't take until, probably wasn't until like after 2015, like maybe 2016 or 2017.
No, that's 2017.
No, I'm not joking, dude. It took that long. Again, I want to emphasize this wasn't because they did anything wrong or anything like that. I think it took that long for me to feel like I deserve to be there. That's why. Up until that point, I felt like I was not living up to what I, like even like a personal standard I set for myself. And I'm not saying after 2017, I fucking turned into a phoenix and I was like, I'm fucking perfect. No. It was more like after that point, I felt like I had at least made enough progress to not feel like I was a disgrace. But I think until the years between 2013 and like 2016, 17, I was so unhappy about the work I was doing that I think because I couldn't get over that, I never felt like I belonged.
Wow. Yeah. I just can't believe it's 2017 because that was the year I did BlizzCon with you. And at that point, I remember you being pretty much integral to the broadcast and being very friendly with everyone there. So I was like, it can't be 2017.
I mean, I was friendly with everyone, but it didn't. That doesn't mean I felt like an integral part myself.
Mm, that's so weird. I would say that people started thinking of you as a integral part of the StarCraft 2 scene probably more around 2015, if I had to guess.
Mm.
And so when you started to do more CSGO events, that was seen as kind of like...
Yeah, they were like, traitor!
Yeah. There was the whole betrayal and the StarCraft 2 scene doesn't like when people leave us and all that good stuff. Yeah. But it definitely was sad. And every time, you know, you weren't doing the hosting, people were questioning why not. Because you were also one of the... It felt like you were one of the last ones to even move on, actually.
Mm.
Where Seltzer had moved on and Red Eye had moved on and Cobra. Shout out to Cobra.
By the way, Chobra. I just want to say something because I remember the first event that I did CS, or one of the first events that I did CS and Chobra did StarCraft. It wasn't my fucking decision, dude. DreamHack was like, hey, can you do CS? Because we would really like Chobra to do StarCraft. And I was like, the community is definitely going to be seeing me as like a fucking traitor. Is it possible? And they were like, no, it's like one of the only opportunities we have for Chobra to do something for StarCraft. We'd really appreciate it. I remember this. It was DreamHack Austin 2016.
Yeah, I remember that as well.
Yeah, it was DreamHack Austin 2016. And I remember I was so like deathly scared about what the community sentiment would be. And of course, lo and behold, they were not very happy about it. But yeah, I just want to put that out there. It was not my decision, some of it.
But I guess, you know, on that note, you did... Well, how did you get into CSGO? Like, literally, how did you get into the game? And then how did you get into the games?
So, Counter-Strike was something that I also grew up watching my brother play. I owe him a lot. He not only played StarCraft, but he was really into Counter-Strike. And so, I already had, again, like a foundational understanding. He played 1.6 back in the day, so it wasn't Go. But Go is still quite similar in terms of, like, if you've only watched 1.6 and you watch Go for the first time, you'll still know what's going on. The first time I got asked was, I believe it was DreamHack Valencia 2015. And the way that it worked and the reason I said yes was because they wanted me to host for three different events at the same time that weekend. And I don't remember how the timing worked out, but it did. It was StarCraft, Heroes of the Storm, and CSGO. And they wanted me to work all of StarCraft, including the finals. And then they wanted me to do just the finals for, I think, Heroes of the Storm, and then just the finals for Counter-Strike. And so that was my first entry into CS.
Huh. Why did they do that?
I think they were trying to save money, to be honest.
Well, yeah.
I think they didn't want to hire like an extra host for these things. And they were like, just have Sue do it. We've worked with her. And I think they really liked me as a person. And they were like, we're used to working with her. She's not like perfect, but just plop her there. And at the time, CS was at a point where it was growing massively in size, but it wasn't nearly close to its apex of popularity that would be a huge risk for them to do so. It was like, you know, if there's like a graph of Bitcoin value, it wasn't nearly at its apex. It was like right there, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah. So gotcha. That's why they took the risk.
Not the 20,000 it was like days ago.
No.
All right, yeah. But I mean, I still think it was kind of weird, though. Because I would expect for Heroes, they would have had someone from the scene. Heroes actually pretty good about taking people from the community because it was basically one of the first esports to be released out this idea of esports.
Yeah, you know? Again, that tournament happened before they fleshed out an entire crew of talent for Heroes. So I happened to enter at like this opportune moment where there was like no fleshed out talent for either this or this, and they were like, plop, Sue.
That's so weird. I would have been to CSGO at least to have it. I mean, I know a lot of those guys were watching StarCraft towards 2010, but my perception of it was that they were all at least playing it and getting popular and kind of, you know, waiting patiently and then exploded. But I guess it worked out perfectly for you. So you never really had to have this fear that you were taking someone else's spot, which I feel like can happen nowadays.
Yeah. Back when I first began working as a host for Counter-Strike, there really wasn't a designated host, which, again, I think when a lot of times when people talk about their journeys of getting to where they are, they always say it's a combination of like hard work, luck, you know, work ethic, stuff like this. Luck for me, I feel like I was always at the right place at the right time. Like I started working CS events right when there was a big dearth of established just stage host talent, typically up until that point, because again, CSGO up until that point hadn't been that as massive as it eventually became. It was usually the casters that just did the interviews. Like it was like they pulled the analysts or the casters and those were the guys that did it. And then of course they had established desk host talent, but they didn't have that one person to work as a stage host. So I came in and I did that event, and then they were like, oh, she can do it. Like she did her research and blah, blah, blah. So I began to do all of the other CSGO events DreamHack produced as well.
That's so amazing to think of when you compare it to, I guess, the amount of people and the skill of the people who are doing the stage and desk hosting now, right?
I know, like, that's so what many. I'm saying. That's how bad it was that they were like, yep, Sue, let's use her!
So when did you kind of have a basic understanding of the game, sure, but I mean, how quickly did you have to turn around on knowing the scene for that game?
Yeah, that was really hard. I knew the game well because I was actually playing a lot of it in 2014. Like that used to be pretty much all I streamed back in 2014 when I used to stream. So I was very familiar with the game, but I had never watched the pro scene. And I was fortunate in that my now fiance and I were getting closer at the time, and he really drilled me and coached me on a lot of the scene because he was a former pro player that was playing for one of the top teams in the world. So he was extremely familiar with all of the teams, all of the players. And I remember the day of, he was like, hey, come with me. I was like, okay, what are you doing? And he was like, just come. And I was like, And then he went and introduced me to all the players. And I'm literally standing there like, nice to meet you. And in my mind, I'm like, what the fuck is he doing? These pro players don't give a fuck about who I am. Stop it. Like, I felt so awkward. But he's just so nice. And he had such good rapport with the players that he didn't see any problem with doing it. And I'm sure they didn't mind either. But in my little fledgling eyes, I was like, stop. But I'm glad he did. Yeah,
that's really cool. Was there a lot of prep work? Did you have like a system?
I actually had a notebook that I probably still have somewhere, but I filled up like 10 pages of notes. I just wrote down all of the 8 teams that were there, their names, obviously, who was the star player. I wanted to have the foundational things about each team written down. And because I'm someone who learns really well, but even just the act of writing it down helps ingrain it into my head. So I would write down, you know, who's the star player, who's the opera, who's the in-game leader, who... And I'm getting into technical things now, but I would write things like that down. And then more overarching things like, over the last 12 months, how has this team been performing? Who is this team's rival? Do they have any rivalries with certain teams? Are they in a slump? Are they on the rise? Things like this.
Okay, yeah. Sounds like pretty good prep. And then did you find yourself more nervous or less nervous or same nervous?
I was nervous, but it was helped by the fact that I was actually hosting with James Duffield, who is actually someone who used to work at Twitch as well at the time, but he did a little bit of on-air talent work. And so because we were kind of splitting the attention, I felt a little less like all the eyeballs are on me.
Yeah.
And that helped me a lot.
Okay. And to stick on kind of the same subject, you recently did a Valorant gig. I don't know. Am I skipping any big esports that you've done between that and Valorant?
No.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
And so before there is, and I'm like, I just don't remember you.
maybe.
Oh, wait. How could I forget? I also did a Heroes of New Earth event.
Oh, wow. I hope you got paid lots of money for that.
That was also an event where DreamHack plopped me.
Yeah, no doubt.
They plopped me, and I remember there was like a Han forum, and they dubbed me the Asian female interviewer lady.
So just the ingenuity of Twitch chat, right?
Like, you know, I didn't mind though, because I think there was no lower third, so they didn't know who I was. They were just like, "Oh, this is Asian female interview related."
Oh, all right,
exactly. Yeah.
All right. But anyway, so you recently did Valorant, and I mean, can you talk a little bit about how that went down? Did you just get offer? They were just like, "Hey, you do things."
Yeah. So honestly, this offer caught me off guard. It was like a fucking punch in the face. Not because I thought I was really bad or anything, because by this point, by this year, I think I've improved so much that I feel pretty confident that any event that I work, I can do a good enough job where I don't feel like a disgrace anymore. Like I said, I used to feel for like 4 years straight. But it was more that I felt that Riot had such a plethora of fantastic on-air talent that could do this role that I was really shocked that they reached out to me specifically. So it was less about like, I don't think I'm good enough, and more about, this feels random when they have all of these other people that I know they can reach out to. So I was really caught off guard. The producer later told me that he had been eyeing me for a while and has wanted to work with me. And when Valorant came out, he thought I'd be a perfect fit for it, just because of my Counter-Strike background and for the type of tone he wanted to set for this show. He wanted to set a very separate tone than the tone they usually use for something like LCS. And so he thought I'd be a good fit for the overall flavor he wanted for this specific show. So it was a shock to me, but I was really happy to be asked.
And do you think you're going to, you know, continue doing Valorant gigs?
I think I would love to. It's hard for me to say if I can, just because I do, again, have the full-time job at Twitch. But I let them know that I would absolutely love to be a part of any events that they do in the future, as long as timing works out.
Yeah. That's still pretty cool. I mean, it makes sense. I feel like they are trying to make it established as a CSGO competitor more than anything else, even though it is also like kind of like a team arena thing as well with all the spells. So I do think that they fit it pretty well. I was surprised to see the other talent they had, but it all made sense. I mean, we're at this like phase where, you know, I brought up the Heroes thing, so just to flesh that out first, like when Heroes came out, it was the first esport that just came onto the scene. So it was one of the first times you had everyone who was maybe not really succeeding in their said esport or didn't see a future in it. They just were like, okay, gotta jump on it. So that created a very odd kind of atmosphere.
Like politicalness.
Yeah, exactly. But eventually they kind of, you know, they got chill and they got a lot of homegrown talent from it, so that's fine. But now you're in this spot where there's a lot I mean, there's a lot of money coming in, mm-hmm. first of all, but then there's also just like a lot of people who are showing that they want to do many esports. They want to diversify. So mm-hmm. you get a guy like Golden Boy, who's done plenty of things. Mm-hmm. That makes a bit of sense. Okay, fine. But then you also get Rivington the Third. Is that his name? Mm-hmm. The League of Legends guy. And it's like, well, where did that come from? Except that he's, you know, he's from Riot. Like, what's going on there?
He actually has an FPS background. Like, before, he was the League of Legends guy, which is obviously why he became so well-known and established as talent. His background is FPS. It's just, he's been in the scene for so long. And when he first started out, much to no one's surprise from how things were back then, you know, he wasn't a big guy. He was just a guy who had passion like anyone else. But it wasn't until the leak stuff that I think his name really got put out there. But he actually loves FPS. And I think he's ecstatic to be able to return to his roots.
Oh, that's very cool then. Yeah, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, those are things that I don't know, but it's probably being talked about a lot behind, you know, when they're actually choosing people. So I think they did a really great job. I watched a decent amount of it. I like watching other esports and the pageantry and how they set up and what their casting is like. So anyways, I just wanted to kind of throw that in there while we're talking about, you know, getting on to new esports. But to work more on the hosting role, I mean, I want to make sure I don't miss stuff that I already know about you. And the people might want to know. So you are still pretty darn nervous, if I may say so, for you when it comes to these live events, and you're constantly asking questions. I mean, do you ever feel like, I don't know if you ever talk to these other, you know, interviewers and hosts, do you ever feel like you need to be so much more prepped, or have you kind of like gotten comfy in your role, just kind of acknowledging that these other people are going to be able to tell you better things?
Wait. Re-ask that question.
Have you gotten comfy in your role as someone who's not expected to be an expert? So you're constantly asking like the casters instead, or do you still kind of wish that you could put more time into being, you know, an analyst yourself?
I've definitely gotten comfy as someone who, I don't think you, or not just you, but whether it's someone that I work with in CS or someone that I work with in Valorant, I don't think anyone across those three games that I've worked in would ever expect me to be an expert. And I don't expect myself to ever be an expert. Like, I will never play StarCraft at a master's level, not unless I put in extensive time toward it. And I know I just won't. I will never understand Counter-Strike and the depths of strategy that are, you know, being played out on a map like an analyst does who used to be an IGL for a team. I will never understand the executes being done in a Valorant map the way that Sean Garris does, because he plays the game at Radiant level. I fully acknowledge that. And I think it's important to understand your strengths and weaknesses. That is not going to be one of my strengths. And I think that's fine. I think as a host, your job isn't, I mean, yes, if you do happen to understand the game at that level, that's fantastic. That can be one of your unique strengths that you can bring to the table in your interviews. But usually in my interviews, I focus less on the strategy anyway. I'll bring it up where relevant if we saw something crazy that happened, or if we saw something or are going to be seeing something that's a little bit different. But typically, the way I like to structure my interviews is not with strategy as a focus. So in my own case, I don't think it's a huge deal. And that's why I think I feel comfortable reaching out to you or the other analysts that I'm working with for questions, because I know you guys have that as a strength, and I don't feel uncomfortable tapping into that strength and getting sanity checks from you guys.
Have you ever talked to the other hosts and interviewers that, you know, do they actually show a preference for perfecting their role in a particular scene, or are they kind of in agreement with you that they shouldn't be an analyst anyways?
No, that's a good question. I haven't talked to them specifically about it, but I just observe. So I'll observe how people conduct interviews in League or how people conduct interviews in CS. And I also see they're not leaning into understanding the game at 100%. But they don't need to, right? That's the thing. It's like, I think a lot of people may have a misconception that everyone that works on our talent need to understand the games inside and out. And the truth is, like, that's never going to be the case. Not even the best analysts are going to be able to understand the game like Sarah Lover does, right? We can get close, and some people are going to get closer than others, but, like, you know, you should spit in my face if I ever say, oh yeah, I know exactly why Sarah made that move, you know?
Yeah. So
even when I look at other hosts and interviews specifically in other sports, or sorry, not sports, other esports, I notice they do the same thing where they focus more on the larger storyline versus the strategy that just happened in the game.
In a similar vein, what about being a part of the community then? Like, how much do you see that you have to prove yourself to any communities as you come in as a host?
That's such a funny thing that you say that. I do think that's one of the pitfalls people can fall into. And I say this as someone who did the same thing. When I first entered CS, it was such an insecurity of mine to feel like I needed to prove myself as someone who, I do the research and I look up these statistics. I'm not just a random girl that got hired to fill a diversity quote. I deserve to be here. Like, I had such an insecurity about it that I remember I was bringing up the most useless stats because I wanted to show I was doing research, right? So as an example, I might be like, Jess, I noticed that you have a 47.7 win rate on Inferno. And like, you know, I remember the players would kind of look at me sometimes like, that's a fucking random statistic you just threw at me, but okay. And I remember there was a time period where I did this early on in my StarCraft 2 days where I would do it with players. I'd be like, you have a 37.3 win rate in your Zerg versus Zerg. I think what happens is if you get too gung-ho about this urge to show people that you know your stuff, you spend more time on saying fluff phrases and stats that honestly don't add anything to the interview and less time on thinking about ways to get as much information out from the player, in my own experience. So that was kind of a learning lesson I needed to personally get over is, why are you on this broadcast? Are you on this broadcast because you're trying to prove to everyone that you deserve to be there? Or are you on this broadcast because you're actually trying to do your job well, which is like be a host or be a caster? Really figuring out, like, stop doing this and do this.
Uh-huh. I think it's a struggle for all aspects of, like, all roles, actually. Mm-hmm. I was talking with Uber, and one of the big things we talked about was that letting go of that ego for being a play-by-play guy, because you're the one talking consistently, you're probably going to make mistakes. That's what I had to really get over, was that, you know, I'm so used to watching it unfold and being like, well, here's why it happened. And then now I just have to, like, let it go and just let the ego go and bring what is actually a very fun aspect of the cast, which is just being like, I don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
It's actually fun. but I think it does apply to, like, every role even. I think it's the analysts in general also go through that whole phase of being like, I'm the best analyst, I'm better than that analyst because I know the stats.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually it's like, well, are you delivering it in a good way? Are you telling the story with them?
Absolutely.
Not getting bogged down in so many details. But it feels like one of those things where it's like you have to know the rules to break them, though. Like, everyone has to go through this phase, unfortunately, before they really understand when to push stats, when necessary, and when to pull back off stats.
And that's why I still do the prep work. Like, I still actually have those stats in front of me, usually, when I'm doing an event. Even like every WCS event I've done this year, a WCS, oh my God.
Well, y'all said fuck on a broadcast. Show,
the World Championship Series is still grilled in my brain. No. But, you know, every event that I worked this year, I still had like a Ligilag open, or even for Valorant, like I had the stats open in front of me. And I just pick and choose when to actually bring it out, right? So I think there was only one time all year, maybe, I brought it out in StarCraft, and it was because I think it was Serral or somebody had like an 87.7 win rate in the last 50 matches, or it was something
in PVZ probably. Yeah, it was 40 matches.
Yes, it was something ridiculous where I was like, okay, this is actually a good point to talk about it because it was like in an analyst desk setting, and I thought it. But normally I realize, okay, there's no need for me to be forcing numbers down everyone's throats just to prove that I have these stats in front of me and I'm doing the research. No, it's not necessary.
Yeah. So then in your mind, how do you connect with the community? Do you bother to connect with the community? I mean, sure, throwing out stats is going to make you seem big brain to some of the guys who are analytically minded, the guys who are looking to drag people down. But if that's not that important, then is there some way to be like, I do love your game, guys. I do really appreciate the opportunity.
I honestly feel if you truly love the game, it'll show. Like, for example, I think I'm sort of an odd case in the StarCraft 2 talent that we have where I am not constantly streaming StarCraft 2. I am not constantly casting over the different various events that's happening. I'm sort of this anomaly where I just come in for some events and then I fly out,
and you out.
Or figuratively or metaphor or whatever you want to say. So I'm kind of an anomaly, but I think the reason I've been able to retain my status, so to speak, not just because of whatever talent I've built up over the years, but I do think I can deliver a level of authenticity, of interest in what's happening via the players or the tournament or where we're at, no matter what game it is. So whether it's Valorant or Counter-Strike or StarCraft, I have a genuinely vested interest in what is happening. And I think that I can convey that on camera. And I think if you can show that this isn't just a 9-to-5 for you, like you're coming in and showing up and how do you feel? Thank you so much. Back to you, Jess. You know what I mean? Like, I think if you can show a genuine vested interest in my case, in the player that you're interviewing, that's what you can do to show you're a member of the community, that you're not any different from the person watching at home that wants to know the answers to these questions, you know?
Yeah. And I guess it all goes back to story. I mean, if you're genuinely interested in this player's story or the team's story, you're going to ask the question that the fans are also going to be like, oh, thank God she asked. I was thinking the same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's pretty important. So recently you also got to do, so when we say hosting, it's, we use the term kind of for everything.
Yeah, it's loose.
So you mostly are a stage host and then you're on stage interviewing as well when you do that. But you recently got to do more of a desk host role, the online EPT. You almost made me say WCS, man. but yeah, your EPT. So how was that transition? Did you know it was going to be difficult? Did you think it was difficult? Did you not want to do it that much?
So I do find desk hosting 10 times harder than interviewing for a variety of reasons. Interviewing is something where I think because I'm a naturally empathic person, it just comes a little bit easier to me anyway. It's like a one-to-one conversation you're having with a person. I have time to prepare and think about what are the best four questions I can possibly ask and given this moment in time that we're at in this tournament. There's just so much prep work I can do for a desk segment. Yes, you can prepare like a skeletal outline, but otherwise, like, you're kind of roaming free and you're kind of leaning on these two other people or sometimes three other people to really give you something to work off of. And sometimes you don't really have to do much. You literally just have to turn the car left once and then the car starts driving itself, and then you kind of turn the car right and it starts driving itself. But sometimes, like, you have to do everything. You have to press, like, you have to turn the radio on. You have to, like, just change shifts. You have to. So I quickly realized with desk hosting, there's a lot more CPU usage going on in my head.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, I'm at, like, 95% and the computer starts overheating. Just kidding. It's just very difficult because there's, you on the one hand have to keep in mind where you're at in terms of the schedule, like what do I have to talk about next? Oh, there's this graphic coming up next and it's coming up in about 2 minutes. So if Jess is talking now, that means Ravi is probably going to talk next, and I have to time this so that I'm thinking about all of these things. While trying to ensure the conversation sounds flowing and has some structure and isn't this loosey goose going nowhere conversation.
Yeah, and that you aren't a parent. You're not a parent in that you weren't quite listening. You were thinking, I think.
Yeah. It's this.
Can be difficult.
Yeah.
yeah, definitely. I think we're very different people in that aspect, I think. Because I see you also, like, you know, do these preps. And I could definitely see doing it more so for the hosting, you know. So I'm talking about literally going out on stage and saying, welcome crowd to IEM 2017 or whatever, right? I could see it kind of doing for that. And I've seen you do it, and I've seen you pace back and forth and just, like, say the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, like a crazy person.
Which is actually the first thing that I did when I did the hosting for the first season. That was the first instinct I had, because I did felt very nervous. And I was like, what
is new, right?
Yeah. And that was actually totally bad for me.
Mm-hmm.
I
actually realized it's bad for desk hosting as well. I stopped doing it for desk hosting, and I only do it for stage stuff.
Okay, yeah. Well, then maybe it is the difference there, because I've never tried any stage hosting.
I think stage hosting just feels more, like, theatrical almost.
Mm. Okay.
And I do feel like I have to lean into almost like a different side of me that's extra, extra versus extra. Desk hosting. You can just be yourself, right? Especially yeah, for an online broadcast. So I stopped doing rehearsing and lines for desk hosting, but I probably would still do it for stage stuff.
Okay. And do you see yourself like pushing the desk host job anymore? Like if you were offered a gig offline for it, would you try it?
For StarCraft, yes. But I probably won't be asked just because there's a big dearth of StarCraft 2 events. But if you know, another EPT came up and they wanted me to desk host, I'd be open to exploring it. If that was the only way I could be part of it, which is, you know, what happened in this case this year.
Right.
For Counter-Strike and Valorant, quite frankly, they have a plethora of desk hosts to lean into, so I don't think I would be asked. But if I did get asked, I'd probably say no. Just because I'm kind of at a point now where I really have to pick and choose the events that I do. I think in order to be a desk host that I don't feel like I'm letting people down with the quality of my performance, I feel like I have to spend more time working at it. And because of the full-time job I have, I don't really have that time to invest right now. So I'd rather lean into what I know I can do well, confidently, which is interviewing. So.
Well, then back on the interviewing and hosting. So what are some of the key things that you really worked on? What were some of the people that you looked up to improve over the years?
Yeah, so when I first started hosting, I didn't even realize there should be a structure to the questions you ask and like why you're asking them at that moment and when you should ask certain questions. So for example, I remember when I was working Intel Extreme Masters New York 2013, Red Eye gave me advice that has stuck with me, which is like, he said, you know, it's almost like a onion. He didn't use this word onion. I don't know why I forcibly brought that analogy in here. But he said, you know, the structure of the questions should be like, ask the very specific question first, then take a step back and ask a little bit more of a general question next. And then your last question should be the, like, you took the most steps back. And that very basic structural advice stuck with me. And by now, I'm sure like you've worked so many events with me, you'll notice I have an order for how I do things. The first question is almost always going to be about the importance of what just happened, which was, let's say, Cyril just reached the semifinals of EPT. Like, you know, I'll usually frame and bring that up like, oh, this is your first semifinal this entire year. Or in Cyril's case, it's like, here's your 15th sum of, you know, like something. I try to first hit on the importance of why it was significant that he won this specific match we just saw. Because that is something a player will never say themselves. But I think it's important for the viewers at home to understand why this win is important.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll start there. I might ask a question or two about the game itself, if it was really outstanding. But in case it's not, I'll take a step back and ask something a little bit more generic, whether about where we're at in the tournament or something about maybe how the player is doing or something. And then I'll take another step back. But that structural advice was something that I found extremely important. Apollo gave me really good, just foundational hosting advice. Little things on how to throw, how to open, tone, little things like instead of saying, welcome back, everyone. Like, welcome back, everyone. Like, having conviction in when you say things as a host. Like, when I say I knew nothing, I fucking knew nothing. Apollo was literally taking this rag doll of a human being and force feeding this child nutrients so they can grow. It was hilarious. I owe Apollo literally everything. Everything I do, I learned probably 95% from him with the start that he gave me. And then like the remaining 5% is just over time, I realize, okay, Sue, you're doing this a lot. You should probably stop.
Yeah. And so does that include like VOD reviews or do you just kind of pick up on it as you do it?
I actually do VOD review almost instantly. I'm sure you've also seen me do this at events. I'll actually pull up the interview as soon as I'm back in the green room.
Yeah, but sometimes it's because you know something went wrong. And yeah, I'm like, why would you do this to yourself?
No, but like... Even when I think it went right, I watch it again anyway, because again, I'm not someone who does on-air talent work naturally. Like, it's a very much consciously working on improving and putting this brick here and this brick here. And not everyone is that way, but it is for me. So it takes me watching to realize, wow, I am moving my hands a lot. Like, that is actually really distracting. Or, wow, I nod way too much. Like, I need to stop doing that. It's actually a detriment to the broadcast that I'm moving my head that much. I look like a bobblehead. Or, why did I use the word obviously three times in that question when I could have just cut that word out and the question still retains its value? So things like this, I just try to do it because I still have a lot to work on. So
it's a constant process. I mean, mm-hmm. Even if you're a bit more structured for your hosting and interviewing, still, it's like it's one of these skills that just is hard to ever be like, yep, that was perfect.
Yeah.
Very rarely. So now, like, I mean, so many years later, I mean, so many gigs later and mm-hmm. such a, you know, powerful position in esports, you're now more so seen as someone who's a mentor as opposed to someone who's a mentee. Mm-hmm. I knew you were gonna do that, but it is true. You know, people, you know, really look up to you when if you're like, you know, saying like if Smix offers you advice, then you should really take it type thing, where if it's some Joe Schmo, then who really cares? But I mean, have you ever done that to anyone else? Have you ever, I guess, paid it forward after Apollo tried to help you out? Have you ever watched these other hosts and been like, oh, they did that wrong, should I go reach out to them?
You know, it's really funny that you say that, because I didn't ever think I could be someone that could give advice until someone asked me for advice for the first time, and I was like, you want me to give you advice? Like, that's hilarious, but okay. For me, it's like I won't go out of my way to give advice to people, just because it can be offensive, you know, like to just cold reach out to someone like, hey, by the way, you fucked up, bitch. Just kidding. But, you know, it's just, I think the best way to absorb advice is when you're openly seeking it yourself. To kind of get cold advice from someone you don't have established rapport with, that just feels awkward. Like, for example, if Apollo reached out to me today and gave me advice, that I welcome that because we have established rapport. Mm-hmm. But if random Joe Schmo from other community who's watched me host for the first time gives me advice, I'm immediately defensive. I'm like, this is the first thing you're ever going to say to me is like this,
yeah,
this, this.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think there's a time and a place, but I always, always welcome, like, if anyone were to go out of their way to reach out to me and say, hey, can I get advice for this thing I did, or, you know, Y thing I did? I'm always happy to help there.
Mm-hmm. And what do you see when you watch these other hosts, you know, maybe not the ones who are on the same level doing like all the major gigs, but if you've ever watched any of like more of the B streams, C streams, what do you see as the most common problem you see in them that you were doing yourself years ago?
I think that you can segment problems into buckets. I think the most obvious problem that even Joe Schmo, who knows nothing about broadcasting, can notice is like technical polished problems, right? Mm-hmm. So like that's the bucket where even if I know nothing about broadcasting, I can tell if that person stuttered, or I can tell if that person flubbed their words. So, and I say this as someone who's also struggled with this particular bucket for my entire career of hosting, because I'm not naturally well-spoken. And it's so funny because I've actually found that one of the ways I try to combat the lack of well-spokenness in myself is... You're going to be like, what the fuck, Sue? I move my mouth weird. So, okay.
Okay, okay.
So as an example, I'll be like, like I my mouth will start doing weird gymnastics. And I noticed that the Valorant event I did, my mouth was like I look like fucking Two-Face from Batman a couple of times because my mouth was doing funny stuff. But the reason I was doing it was because, again, CPU usage. I was dedicating about 40% of my CPU usage into not flubbing up my words.
Mm-hmm.
And the mouth gymnastics was helping me not do it. Does that make sense?
No, it actually does. But you know what's so funny is that it's technically incorrect.
Do that?
Yeah, it's very incorrect to do that.
Okay. Well, so today I learned, ladies and gentlemen, don't look like Two-Face.
Yeah. So not only does it look weird, I mean, that's not even it, right?
I do
look
weird.
I'm doing some voice acting, getting lessons for it and whatnot. And one of the first things that happened when he was like, turn your camera on, let me see you work. Because they want to check, you know, your posture and then want to check how your mouth moves. Is that he was like, you talk out of the side of your mouth a lot.
I do that.
I'm doing right now.
I do that.
So it's literally like it's technically with the mic, it's not working as well as it should. And then like your technical, like your body isn't moving. The body is supposed to be just like a straight and narrow. So that's why you're supposed to stand tall, have a good posture, really breathe in from the stomach, right? Yeah. And then push it out and then direct as well. So that's, I still do it as well. I think it's a very casual thing. But what you are supposed to do that's why I said it's like technically incorrect. But if it works for you, then, you know, and it's just personal like idiosyncrasy, then fine. Mm-hmm. What you are doing right is that you're supposed to open your mouth to an uncomfortable degree of what you usually would to get the most air out and to make sure you don't stumble over your words.
Yeah. I happen to have a large ass mouth. So, I think I was just like, I think I was trying to do a combination of those two things, but I just remember, you know, some of the common sources of criticism I got for that event was like, why does she fucking speak so weird? Like, why is her mouth looking so weird? And I remember thinking to myself, would I rather technically stumble but look normal, or would I rather look weird but not technically stumble? And I was like, I think I'd go with the latter and then eventually work out the weird mouth movements and retain that technical finesse, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a very good question. Which one?
But you know, my logic is the technical bucket is the one that stands out the most. To even untrained eyes, if someone stumbles, that is going to be seen as like massive red flag. So I think that is the most common sort of mistake I see. Even obviously with BCAS, CCAS, whatever. It takes the longest for perhaps some people to get over. There are going to be some people who are naturally gifted and just don't struggle with things like that, which I've always been so jealous of. Like, you know, plenty of people like that. I know so many people like that in this industry that are just well-spoken both on camera and off. I'll be in the hotel lobby with them and sometimes I'll be like, you are just as eloquent and I want to punch you in the face. Like, we're literally four shots in and you still sound like there's a camera rolling. But yeah, I think there's a technical bucket, right? So let's move that to the side. That's the really obvious one of common errors that you can make. I think the other error is, again, lack of awareness. So like either not paying attention to the people you're working with, whether it's a co-caster, whether it's the other people on the desk or whatever it is, or just like not being aware of how you're coming across. Because again, I see this so often when someone looks like they're trying to prove something, they're trying so hard to look like they know their stuff. And let me show you how much I know my stuff. Okay. Look at my arsenal of research that I've done. Let me just show you. Okay. This is page number one. You ready? Okay, now this is page. No. Let me finish this last point. Page number three. Okay, look how prepared I am. And it's like, no, that's like showing those three pages actually did nothing for this broadcast. All it did was show that you're really desperate to show why you deserve to be here. But like, just by doing that, you're showing why you don't deserve to be here. That's a really common bucket I see as well. And then I think for hosts specifically, sometimes there's too much of a focus on what just happened. And I think the most impactful story building you can do is give contextual background for a player that goes beyond just this one tournament that's happening. Like, okay, we're watching this player do extremely well at this tournament. That's cool. But like, why is that important? And why should I care? Oh, is this the first tournament that they've done well in this entire year? Actually, is this the first tournament that they've done well in the entirety of their 8-year career, then that's suddenly way cooler. And I see a lot of times hosts don't give that extra context of, okay, wow, we just saw a really great game and that's it. That's all they'll like, their focus and their lens will stay there. But it's like, actually, if you take a step back and you show the wider lens of why this win here is important, it can make big fans from viewers that are watching over this player and give them another reason why they should care.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Zooming out's really one of the most important roles of the host. desk and stage. Mm-hmm. And it's also what's going to attract most of the viewer base. You mm-hmm. know, it's great to get the guy. It's great to get a pro gamer saying that you know your stuff. That's actually mm-hmm. a very good feeling, but it's actually not really the most important feeling. So being able to step back and zoom out and, you know, I would say even sometimes I think about what tweets have drawn me into other esports. And whenever I get to watch a CSGO thing, it's usually mm-hmm. because A, they were breaking a Twitch number record. That was pretty hype. And then like another one was just like the Astralis, like, I guess, story that's been building up, yep. you know, the undefeated one, the mm-hmm. fifth, those types of things yeah. are what you click into, right?
Yeah.
Not the, this guy had an amazing headshot.
No, it's like, not
oh,
at
that's
all.
Cool. But,
but not really.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's actually pretty, like, maybe learn something from social media managers. I don't know. There's something.
No,
there.
It's true though. But I think specifically with interviewers, that is the most common. I don't even want to call it an error because it's not necessarily a technical error, but it's something that I think could level up their interviews like 10x.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I guess to bring it to like a general esports, to zoom out on this, like, what do you, you've done so many big esports at this point, you know, include Valorant, even the one job is still pretty big. Like, what do you see being pushed? Like, how to ask this question? What do you think is what could be brought to StarCraft, for instance, from some of these other esports? Like, what's really pushing good production nowadays?
You're making me sad because all the things that I want, it needs money.
Mm.
And maybe I'm being a little too transparent here, but budgets for StarCraft 2 productions have been slashed compared to the budgets for the other esports, like right. Counter-Strike as an example. But something that Valorant did that I thought was so good, everything from the equal production for all the talent, it goes a long way in making the broadcast not feel like an online broadcast. Like every single person, caster, host, whatever, had the same exact backdrop, same exact cam quality, same exact audio quality. It was all the same. So you would almost forget that we're all actually at home because you can't tell we're at home. Because everyone has the same backdrop, right?
Right.
That's like one thing that, considering we're an online broadcast, really levels up the professionalism and the caliber of the event instead of feeling like this, like, okay, we're just like rolling up in our offices and we're all trying to hype this event, but like I might not be wearing pants under this because you can clearly tell I'm at home. The other thing is they had so much B-roll. So they freaking went out and they did like solo pieces on one player from every single team, at least one. And then they would also do, in addition to that one, like deep dive on one player, like let's say like Skadoodle from, you know, from T1. In addition to that, they would do like another B-roll feature on just that team and their story. Like it was, they had so much B-roll footage where, and like, that specifically takes so much money and I get it, but it added so much to the show. I would yeah. watch these features on players and immediately feel like I have a bigger reason to cheer for them. Because mm-hmm. of course, in the interview, they talk about like, what does this mean to you? And you know, talk about your journey and whatever it is. And you get to see what makes them as not just great players that are great at this esport, but like who they are as a human. And that's what really makes you fans of them, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like that is one thing that has lacked so much in StarCraft. Like we started doing a little bit in the signature player series a few BlizzCons ago, but again, takes a lot of budget. And I don't know if we're going to get that again.
Yeah, it's the sad reality. And that's a lot of the responses to similar questions that I've asked people. It's just like, you know, what's your perfect tournament? What's your perfect scene and whatever? And it's like, you know, money, money, money. But I do think there's some other things that, you know, a push that they're not necessarily about money. Like, for instance, talk a lot about duo casting, like having a duo in these esports is now kind of, you know, the thing to do.
Yeah, you're right.
To be mm-hmm. paired up with people. And if that's actually the best thing to do, should StarCraft do that or not? I don't believe so, but it's a question I ask a lot of people. Or, you know, how their death segment is prepared. Like, you can compare Dota's desk segments to StarCraft 2 desk segments or to CSGO desk segments. And there's a wide range of how casual mm-hmm. they are versus how
professional. Yep, that's a good question as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, these are all the things that I think, you know, when I start giving examples, it's a bit unfair to just bring you be like, what's the best thing to do? And it's like, of course, it's money. More money, please. But to maybe give you some examples, like, can you, does that spark anything that, you know, can say, like, would be better to bring back to StarCraft 2? Or is StarCraft 2 actually just the best? We're the most casual. We're the tightest group.
I actually think we're not the most casual. I've seen more casual, but...
Okay.
That's a good question. It's a hard question because I think the differences have their merits. And I think that's what you were hinting at when you were saying like, oh, like this port does it like this, or, you know, this game does it like this.
There's never been a time where, like, you know, you've been waiting for us in rehearsals and you're like, oh, they did this in CSGO and I wish that they would do it here.
I actually think there are times where I would listen to you guys during rehearsal and I wish that went out on broadcast. I actually think I think the StarCraft 2 talent are like some of the most intelligent, funniest talent in the space. You're like, yeah, that's me. But I almost feel sometimes that the structure of the desk don't allow for it, or just because there's limited time, you guys maybe don't feel like you have the chance to. But I think seeing more of that would benefit the show, only because I think after a certain point, talking about, you know, Cyril's amazing ZVP gets kind of old after a while. And I think there are ways you can incorporate some of that flair I see only during rehearsals into the actual show that both make it more hilarious for the on-air talent, but I swear to God, the viewers would die. Like, they would die if they knew how funny or how much funnier shit gets sometimes. And I know some of it is not safe for work, and we don't have to go that deep, but like, I just think you guys are so intelligent and there's so much knowledge you inherently have. You can still convey all of that intelligence while bringing out that extra hilarity.
It's fitting more of like a conversation than it is a question and answer, because it is a lot of just thinking. But, you know, I remember being a part of the WCS crew and being like, well, this is how it is. And then the year after, I was like, well, this is how it is all the time.
Yeah.
Like, Jesus Christ.
And it gets stale.
Yeah, it did. It really did. And I thought everyone pretty much agreed with this, but I've actually gotten like a little bit like, oh, I thought it worked fine. I was like,
that's the thing. It's really stale.
It worked fine is the problem. It wasn't anything that was exciting and new and different, something that
but allowed it wasn't for, memorable like, at all.
Yeah, exactly. And then I remember that, and then I see, like, for instance, is it Flashpoint? Shit, it's one of the CSGO ones. Mm-hmm. They do the bar thing.
I know.
Yeah.
Oh my God, how funny would that be if we did a bar thing?
It would be so cool, right? And I know originally there was this whole thing about Blizzard not letting alcohol on stream, but that like isn't even a thing anymore because Overwatch League is fucking like sponsored by Bud Light. I don't care.
I totally agree with you, and I just think there are times with certain esports where I do think the on-air talent, some of them don't really have like the most interesting personalities, and that's not really an insult, because perhaps their strength is like the ridiculous depths of expertise they have in whatever esports it is. But with you guys in particular, I can say confidently, like spending so much time speaking with all of you, you're all so funny. And I just think it's a shame that the official broadcasts only get to see literally 2% of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Imagine like, just like someone with a camcorder watching us during these rehearsals or in the green room.
I think people would literally die. And if we just bleeped out the parts that are a little too much, you know, I just think it's so funny. And I think it's a shame. And I think actually 2021 is the time where we should be experimenting with potential formats to explore more, because what do we got to lose? Can I be real here? What do we got to lose? We don't got much to lose, okay? It's not like we're competing for a number one spot anymore. I think that we are still going to have the really cool players, and we're going to have fantastic games, and we can still tone it down and be serious once it gets to the playoffs and like the quarterfinals, semis, and grand finals. But I think for like the group stage or even the you know, qualifiers leading into the actual tournament, like, we can have more fun. I think it's a waste to just be so official and stale.
Yeah. It is kind of weird. Like, we went along the trajectory that esports generally did, I suppose, which is that it started off with people in t-shirts and headsets, mm-hmm. and then moved on to something a little more suit and tie, but not so much. And then some esports took it extremes. Other esports weren't like, you know, they were like, we did it and then we didn't like it. Let's go back to what we were doing.
You know, and yeah, sorry, finish your thought.
StarCraft is somewhere in the middle, it feels. We were kind of like, well, we got to that point and then we never really said, like, was it working or not?
Yeah.
And so I feel like we actually need to regress in a way. We need to go back to what it was.
Especially if we're not going to get the funds to do something Valorant level, which is fine, by the way. Like, it is what it is. There are ways I think we can capitalize with our current system to still make it more entertaining. Whether it's leaning into that home aspect a little bit, and like, everyone bring out a brewski, or like, do you get what I mean? I think that absolutely. Right now we're in this weird limbo, exactly as you said, where, okay, we're an official broadcast, but like, are we? Am I wearing pants? You'll never know. And like, the main, you know, hilarity comes from me spinning my fucking pen 3 seasons in a row
and cursing.
And cursing accidentally. And you know, that's lame. You know, like, I am the least funny member of all of you guys by far. And if that is what people are honing in on, it's like, wow, like, we're not doing something right. If, you know, the one comic relief is like, oh my God, Sue cursed and said the F word. Like, what are we, 12? I just think it's such a shame, because I think all of you guys, the humor you have is so unique. And actually, like, intelligent humor, not like, like, humor.
I mean, sometimes, though.
No, I think you guys are so funny.
Oh, yeah. I agree. I find myself with you feeling like a funny person, which I'm very shocked at. But when I'm, not because you're not funny. Okay, that came off wrong. You laugh at things I do, but whenever I'm around the other StarCraft casters, I still feel like I'm the one that's like dwarfed by their presence.
No, no, no.
You know?
I think it's such a no. Because this is what I think. I think at the end of the day, humor is one of those things that's incredibly arbitrary. Like, for example, I think Tasteless and Artosis are fucking hilarious, right? But there are times they'll say a joke to each other, and I just don't get it. But it's clearly hilarious, because Artosis is doing his like, laugh, and Nick is like, oh, that's so funny. Oh. And I'm like, oh, fuck, I want to laugh, but I don't get it. Fuck, I don't get it. And, you know, and that's fine. It doesn't mean they're not funny. It just means it didn't hit me, and I'm just maybe not intelligent enough or whatever it is. But that's fine. And that's the beauty of humor, is that it's different strokes for different folks. And I think all of us are very funny in different ways. I just wish people could have seen it more. It almost makes me wonder if, like, there's a merit or some kind of a merit to, like, after the next big tournament, if there was, like, a StarCraft II After Dark show where, like, instead of us just doing the hotel lobby Discord call that we do for 8 hours straight, literally, guys, like, we do it for 8 hours straight where we're just, like, shooting the shit. And maybe we'll keep it more safe for work next time if it is being broadcast. Or we just, like, shoot the shit and like, you know, obviously there should be some structure to that if we're opening it out to being streamed. Mm-hmm. But like, I think that there is some beauty in that, and me just being like, okay, Jess, like, let me unbutton my pants now. Okay. Do you have your beer? Like, tell me how you really felt about Protoss during this tournament. Cause I could tell you were holding back, and you could be like, it's disgusting, Sue. Like, I don't know. You get my point.
No, that's amazing. That's actually an amazing thought. You know, I think it's been 25 episodes and you're the first one to bring up this angle, which is quite amazing. Like, that we should be, because I've talked about like how sometimes it's odd that esports kind of push their casters more than their players. And obviously there should be a desire to move the tournament along and focus on the narratives of these hardworking guys. But there is actually like a lot of the memories and the nostalgia comes from a lot of the casters and all these like really funny moments, and, mm-hmm. and you know, Day 9 falling out of his chair is apparently still incredibly popular, and I'm like, I thought it was okay, but like, why you guys remember this? Okay.
I know.
But anyways, like, that, like, this should be probably pushed. And imagine if it was like after DreamHack and Maynard and Pig, who are in Australia, are like, man, we didn't get to do anything. I didn't want to wake up at 2 a.m. And then instead you bring it in after, you know, 7 p.m. our time, 9 p.m. their time. And it's like, okay, so what happened, guys? And they're like, man, I caught the tail end. And like, what the fuck was that?
You know, I know. And just like, it's like a relatable conversation that where we get to show like, hey, not only are we the people you see on the broadcast, we feel the exact same emotions you do at home. We were also like, what the fuck? We were also like, oh, that was underwhelming. Or we were also really surprised at the performance of this guy. Like, what the fuck? He wasn't supposed to do that. But we can't say it as explicitly as that during our show. We can't be like, that wasn't... Okay, sometimes we do say that. Never mind. But you get my point. You get my point. I think there's so much more room for personality to come out. And that's my biggest gripe is that with this structure that we've put into place with the previous years of WCS that did become quite stale, there wasn't a lot of room for personality to come out. And perhaps TOs could say, well, that's on you guys to bring that out during the show. But I think there's a way or there's a world where they could work with us for a format like the Flashpoint example you gave with the Brewskis and stuff like that to create a environment more conducive to something like that.
Yeah. I would love for it to happen. You know, we'll never know what they intended to do for the first DreamHack of this year.
Yeah, true.
That was one of the big questions we all had was like, who was going to do the hiring? How are they going to do the hiring? Are they going to increase the amount of, you know, the roster, which had really been cut down to the bare bones? And are they going to have a different set, you know? And I'd like to say they would have tried something different, but I'm pretty much sure that they would have gone with the same thing in slightly different colors or something like that, which would be really sad. But it would be an excellent thing to do if we can do it in next year.
Mm-hmm.
Take advantage in a weird but still useful way when it comes to being at home.
Yep.
You know, it's gonna be odd, but you can kind of play into it. Like I think there's stuff that we can do. And initially, just making sure that things worked was fine. But now that we're like really well ingrained, it's time to change it up.
But even if it's like, I don't know, like a hour debrief after the finals to, I don't know. Just I'm thinking
we're still waiting on that debrief we're supposed to have the week after.
Yeah, we are.
All right, so we're getting close to the end here. I just have one more question from the Patreon supporter Smix. All right, so can you remember all the different games that you've worked shows for? Any particular ones stick out or are harder to recall?
Yeah, I do have quite a few that are like stuck in my brain forever. But they're more like moments versus games. Because to me, what leaves an impact is when I know a player just by winning a game set his legacy in that game forever, in that moment. They did something bigger than themselves in that moment. And there are a few times this happened. For example, the first one that happened for me in StarCraft was when 4GG won DreamHack Winter in 2014. It was actually the first time he ever won ever in his StarCraft career, from Brood War to StarCraft 2. And that's why he started crying. That, for me, was the first time I saw something happen that was bigger than just the tournament that we were watching. It was like, this is a moment that has been in the works for a decade, and this player accomplished it. So that was kind of the first like hint of a bigger moment than what we just saw. Some other examples that I can give are, some of them are not going to be StarCraft. Like, when I watched Cloud9, and the StarCraft 2 talent make fun of me for this because they were like, oh, you're such a Cloud9 fangirl. The reason I cried so much when Cloud9 won, and it was because of the history that they made, right? It's like North America was synonymous with like the region that always sucked compared to Europe. It was a never-ending, not even a joke, it just was fact, right? Europe was always the dominant region. NA kind of sometimes had flashes here and there, but oftentimes it was because they had a European import on their team. Like, Team Liquid one time made the grand finals of the major, but it was really off the back of this player, Simple, who is now considered one of the best Counter-Strike players in the world. So it's like, can you really give credit to North America at that point? Or how much of that was leaning on the back of Simple, who's a, you know, world-class player? So Cloud9 winning was this like crazy moment, because not only did they set history as like it was like the first time a North American team won a major, it was like it was just not supposed to happen. They had to beat the top four teams to get there, so it was like so legit in how they did it. They also had to come back from an 0-2 deficit in the round robin like group stage, where if they just lost one more time, they were out. So all of it was just really beautiful. And I think some quick personal background, I used to play volleyball, and I know what it's like to be one player on a team where both the losses and the wins are almost feel bigger than yourself. The losses feel worse and the wins feel greater because you're doing it with other people. And I remember when I was in senior year of high school, we were the number one seeded team in New York City, because we had won a couple of tournaments leading up to that point. And every tournament that we won, as soon as we got that last point, I literally would fall to the floor and just start crying. And it was like a culmination of the physical exertion we all had to put in to get there. But that moment of like, we did this together. Like we fucking did this. Like we were together and we built this win together. And this isn't about me. This is all of us. And it was like always so beautiful to me. And I remember like after you win a volleyball game, you go to the net and you shake the hand of all the players in a row. And every time I'd be like, oh, good game, good game, good game. And it just became like a joke. But for me, I just think there's nothing more beautiful than that. And then add that with setting history and legacy for a game. That's why the C9 one was really big for me. And then the last one, I feel kind of like I'm copping out because all of these wins are like obviously big for obvious reasons. But Cyril winning, a lot of people don't know this, but I cried for like 20 minutes after he won. There is just no video that was put online with like 300 retweets, so people don't know. But I cried for 20 minutes because what he did, it was just amazing. A game as old as StarCraft where people that weren't Korean were almost at a certain point considered like genetically inferior. Like it was just never going to happen, you know?
Yeah.
So I would say it's less the games, but more the moments that leave an impact on me. Sorry if that's a cop out, but
I mean, I don't think anyone's really going to, I mean, I guess if you asked me the same question, I could remember some specific games, but no, it'd always be the moments. And, you know, people ask me about like, you know, like that event you did, what were your favorite games or what were your favorite, what was your best story from that event? And I think they're thinking of like the StarCraft games. And I'm like, oh, I remember events for like the in the lobby, hanging out with friends and like the jokes that were cracked in the green room. I'm like a very terrible person to ask this question.
Yeah, because I feel like at the end of the day, even if we see one of the best StarCraft 2 games in the world, if it happened in the group stage.
Yeah.
You get what I mean? Like how important was it really? And how impressive was it really, right? What you remember is, okay, why was that win important? On a human to human level, why should I care as a human being that this person won this particular game? And that's why I think those wins that I named were so significant and long lasting in terms of why I remember it and why it had such a personal impact on me as a fan of these games myself. Because it creates moments like that where a victory transcends Cyril. It transcends Cloud9. It transcends 4GG. It's like they become proof that you can grind and you can beat the odds, so to speak, and show that, okay, it turns out Koreans aren't genetically superior. If you put in the hard work and you grind and you get better at something, you can become a Cyril. You and I probably won't, and it's not probably, we won't. But you know, it's possible. There are future Cyrils out there, like case in point, Rainer, right? So
yeah,
I just think that's why I want to lean so hard in the future into the human aspect of things, because that is what I think actually leaves an impact on the viewer. Mm-hmm. We have like the technical skill that we see all the time in these games of someone playing out of their mind beautiful StarCraft, but like, does it leave like an impact on you as a viewer if you can't see the human to human impact of what that win did? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so absolutely.
I feel like that's why I try so hard and to ask those more feelsy questions in my interviews, especially towards the latter portion of an event, because I want people to realize, okay, this player reached the semifinals and that's cool and that's important, but why should you care? Why is this moment important? You know, why is Marine Lord reaching the season finals important, right? Like, it's not just because it wasn't supposed to happen, but like, is this the first time he's done something like this in a couple of years? Like, bring that up. You know, is what has his history been as a StarCraft 2 player? Is he supposed to be consistent? Like, no, he's not. Like, just all these things I think are important to bring up, the human aspect of things. And I think we can do better in highlighting that.
Yeah, the I mean, humans are storytellers is I think the very basis, and might be different ways of telling those stories, but mm-hmm. it's actually all about the human effort. And I think that StarCraft esports in general actually should be doing the most to do this. Now, the traditional sports broadcasting has already kind of figured this out. They already do a great job of, you know, they have cameras with the kids who are being told they're going to get into the NFL. That's fantastic. Esports mm-hmm. should be doing an even better job and trying harder yeah. because it is so much more difficult to explain to a person yeah. the technical skill,
like
someone keyboarding as opposed yes. to someone doing a backflip.
Absolutely. The what people don't see are the years that Cyril was a nobody. Like back in 2016 Leipzig, I remember Cyril, I think, was in top 8 or something. And like people were like, oh, Cyril's supposed to be really good. Like, he's supposed to be, you know, one of the best. But he never did anything with it. Like he, at the time, wasn't actually producing results. So does it actually matter that he's this guy that's supposed to be great on ladder? No, because why should I care that he's putting in all this work when he's not producing results? But when he eventually starts producing the results, that's when I feel like all of that backstory matters so much. Because what people don't realize is for Cyril to have become Cyril, he had to play for years and years and years and years. Like there was so much effort that had to happen for him to even get to that point. And yeah. it's easy to miss that when you just see someone start to win all the time. It's like, oh, maybe he always was good. No, he wasn't.
Yeah. Yep, highlighting that struggle is, I think it is the best stories. It's like
yeah.
the struggle is always the key point about any story. So, yeah, it's we always gonna think it a little cheesy. I feel like at the end of some of these episodes because it becomes like this very like philosophical thing, but it is true. I really liked writing when I was younger. I was an avid forum role player, and I did creative writing, and then not so much. And it was like. For a while, I was confused to why I liked commentary until someone kind of just like made a click in my mind that it is storytelling. And everything in life is a story. So
mm-hmm.
it's as I said, it's maybe cheesy sometimes, but it's actually what people should be focusing on and should be enjoying.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. So that's the end of the podcast, Mix. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. You got a good angle as well, a new angle, and I really enjoyed listening to your backstory. I had no idea you were in a brood war. I don't know why I never knew this. I feel like I never talked about it.
It's so funny because when I first came onto the scene, I did a lot of these like, oh, you're a woman in gaming. Tell us how you got into StarCraft. And it got to the point where I was regurgitating the same thing that Rotterdam one time made fun of me. He was like, Smicks, like, it's always so funny. Like, I read these interviews and you're always like, I got into it because of my brother and I watched it. And he like recited the whole story from beginning to end perfectly. And he was like, and I was like, wow, it's that redundant, eh? And he's like, yeah, I just like...
Wow.
So for a while, I just stopped talking about it because I was like, oh, it's just been done. But it was nice to share with someone who genuinely didn't know.
Yeah. News to me. I think I might have known about your brother, but just like, I also could have guessed
yeah.
As well. It's actually a very common trend. I know, I don't know if I should be talking about this. So I'll just keep it vague. So, but like someone was doing a study on why like there are... the women who are currently mm-hmm. working in esports are able to do so, or what their story was to get to that process and where the pitfalls were.
Mm-hmm.
And something like a crazy number, like 80% of them were like my brother
mm-hmm.
or my dad, you know, a male figure. So it's I could have guessed it, but I think I knew it. I just didn't realize you started in Brood War. I feel like
yeah.
we could have talked so much more about the fact that you liked Flash when Bisou was the one that was all the rage in 2008. Like, what's that about, Sue? Like
the revolutionist. Yeah, yeah, I just... Yeah, and I think that's also why I never tried to become the best player or be so good at these games myself. I grew up watching someone else do it, so I was always the viewer from the beginning. So it never occurred to me to try to be better myself because I was always like, I just genuinely like watching these people. And if I can play even a 1% role in helping tell their story, I feel like I'm doing my job. So
that's beautiful. I wanted to defeat my brother. So I went onto
See,
YouTube.
That's a difference, and that's why you're actually good at the game. Meanwhile, I was already like, I surrender. I'm never gonna be as good. So let me just accept that. And from my surrendered role of knowing I'm garbage at video games, let me just try to do what I can to show why this person is really good and why you should care about them being really good.
Yeah. All right. Well, I know you don't do much the Twitch streaming or whatnot, but if you want to shout out your socials and what you might be doing next year, now's the time to do so.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/smix, Instagram, instagram.com/smixity, Twitch is just smix. I stream like once every 3 years. The last time I streamed was actually 2018. I was actually even thinking of streaming after this podcast because I put on makeup and it's COVID and I literally spend 99.9% of my time looking really interesting.
Really interesting, yeah.
Like, I'm basically a cave woman minus the club is the analogy I like to give.
You know, I like feel like I've never seen you without makeup, actually.
Which is, there's a reason for that. Let's just put it that way.
You always get done before we even go down to breakfast.
Sue, is that you? Yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, that's a totally different topic of, like, my own insecurities with my non-makeup self. But, you know, psychology is but yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, I hope to see you stream again. Last time you did it, it was awful lot of fun. Everyone suddenly just came pouring in before you knew it. It was like everyone important in the esports scene was there.
It was cute. I was appreciative.
It was a good time. Yeah. All right. Thank you again. And thank you guys for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope you come back here for the next episode in 2 weeks. Bye.
Bye.